This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com. Did you guys hear about this shooting in Rochester Hills, Michigan? The boy who missed his bus?
Why don't you remind us?
All right. So check this out. So there was a young man in the community. He missed his bus, and I guess he tried to walk to school, and it's several miles to school. And I guess he got lost along the way. And he decides to knock on somebody's door, and a woman answers. I guess she panics, and the husband comes running downstairs with a gun. The kid runs, and the dude shoots at him as he's running away. And he's been charged, I think, with attempted murder. It really struck me, you know, these types of panicked reactions to running into people from other races. I'm wondering, what does race scholarship say about, you know, the role of panic and fear in racism? Like, how much of racism is about people panicking because they're totally scared of black people, for instance, or Muslim people, versus somebody who has sort of like a more calculative or deliberate animus or a desire to, I don't know, exercise ill upon another people, upon an other? Does that make sense, that question?
Yeah, I mean, basically what you're asking is like, what is like the sort of the psychological mechanisms behind, right? You know, yeah. One taking racist actions. And I don't know, I think that's a really good question. I think the one thing behind both is that both are fueled by racist ideas, period. Now, whether those racist ideas, you know, fuels hatred or whether those racist ideas fuels fear, either way, they're still racist ideas that prompt one to actually engage in behavior that is not good. Mm. Not good at all.
I mean, it kind of reminded me of the Philando Castile video where you remember the police. I just remember the voice of the police, and that dude sounded panicked.
Yeah.
Like he was just panicked. And I'm wondering how many of these negative sort of cross-race interactions are a result of people coming to just really fear black men in particular. I mean, Trayvon Martin might have been like that too, right? Like a dude saw a black kid walking in his neighborhood and he's like, oh shit, I better get my gun because mm-hmm. this is going to go down.
No, this actually makes me think a lot about what Patricia Hill Collins has argued about controlling images, right? And sort of like, what are the cumulative effects of constantly being exposed to depictions of, I guess in the cases you just mentioned, of black men as inherently dangerous and criminal, right? And so how much of that is sort of fueling or justifying the panic that, you know, the woman had at the House of Michigan and some of these other sort of more high profile incidents that have occurred, right? So like what sort of justifies or what allows people to justify being afraid of a black man knocking on your door?
Yeah.
Well, didn't the same thing happen in Detroit a couple of years ago? And this time it was a woman. It was a black woman who I can't remember if she was lost or if her car broke down.
Yeah.
And she came to someone's doorstep just to ask for help and they shot and killed her.
Yeah, that does sound vaguely familiar.
Yeah, I can't remember her name for some reason. I think partly because we tend to focus on the black men who get shot in this way, but and underplay the black women who do. So,
you know, police shootings in particular are disproportionately of black people, especially black men. My understanding is that of all police shootings, you know, fatal police shootings, it's something like 30-40% are black men, which is, you know, not a majority, but it's also way disproportionate to black men being about 5-6% of the population. I think in the shootings that don't involve blacks, you sometimes see the same dynamic and sometimes don't. My understanding is that white people are more likely to do kind of a suicide by cop thing, just as white people are more likely to commit suicide in general. But there's there's been white incidents with white victims of police shootings that follow the same basic script as those of black victims of police shootings, where, you know, a cop is trying to arrest or interrogate a suspect and just panics and imagines a gun and shoots the person. Like, you know, I mentioned Daniel Shaver a few minutes ago. That was this white guy. He was in a hotel. He had a BB gun that he used for his job, killing rats in Walmarts at night. And police got a man with a gun call because they saw him holding the BB gun. Somebody saw him holding the BB gun through the window. They tried to arrest him. They gave him a series of confusing directions, and his pants started to fall down. He reached to pull his pants up so he wouldn't be naked, and they shot him when he reached for his waist. And, you know, it was the typical police thing of, I saw him reach for his waist, I thought he was going for a gun. I have absolutely no problem believing that this kind of thing happens way disproportionately with Black people who come in contact with the police. And that, you know, A, Black people, especially Black men, are more likely to come into contact with the police. And B, for any given encounter, it's highly probable that the police might panic more in their contact. Although my understanding is that Fryer's analysis was that it's mostly the first one. It's mostly that cops come into contact with Black people more, and not so much that they're more likely to panic contingent on that interaction. But the issue seems to be panic, and there may be people in general or cops in particular are more likely to panic in context of, you know, interacting with a Black person than they are with interacting with a white person. But it does seem that panic is kind of the driving mechanism for all these.
Yeah. So two things. So the young woman's name who died, and this was in I think in 2013, her name was Renisha McBride.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So I just wanted to make sure that, like, no disrespect, wanted to make sure that I had her name out there, number one. And number two, if you're talking about that Roland Fryer analysis of police shooting, there are so many things wrong with that analysis. I was like, Roland, you know better.
Do you remember off the top of your head what you disliked about it?
So it's been a while since I've read it, but if I think about the main problems I saw with this analysis were, number one, just the sample that he had was nowhere near anything even bordering on representative. And the cities for which he actually did have data, I wish I had that article in front of me. I mean,
wasn't it Dallas or Houston?
It was in Houston.
So it was from Houston, but he also had numbers. I'm pretty sure. So that the article that was referenced in the news on that particular day, like, it was referencing a study that he'd done that looked at multiple cities, right, across the United States. But the cities, I remember at the time thinking, I was like, why these cities? That's kind of odd, right? And there were so many cities missing, especially the cities in which we've seen like quite a few shootings of unarmed Black men and women. So why wouldn't you include those cities? I thought was really interesting. So I think my primary problem was just basically the sample upon which he based his study. And then I think it went downhill from there.
My understanding is another criticism of it, which Fryer himself acknowledged, was that most of his variables were coded by the cops themselves.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. That was another one I forgot about.
And not just like the police in general, but like the responding officer coded his own interactions in the incident.
Yeah, just saying.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.